Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome, everyone, coming to you live from Western Idaho, where our AccuWindow forecast is rain today. Slightly cooler, more comfortable. The solar wind tonight, 452.7 kilometers per second. And the proton count is up to 14.7. So you might want to wear a long-sleeve shirt when you go out tomorrow. A coronal hole is facing Earth and is streaming a powerful solar wind that should reach Earth September 3rd. So watch the northern lights that night. And if you stay aware of them, even in the somewhat southern hemisphere, you should be able to see it, or southern latitudes. It was a powerful, bone-shaking launch as Discovery roared into the night on Friday. Now, some 300 kilometers above Earth, Discovery is about to tag up with the International Space Station. The two spacecraft will dock at 9:03 p.m. tonight. Discovery is delivering equipment to outfit the space station's laboratories. The payload includes new tools for fluid physics research, a minus 80-degree laboratory freezer, and equipment to study materials such as semiconductors, ceramics, alloys, and crystals in low gravity. If you want to see the pair together as one amazingly bright going overhead, just look up tomorrow morning at 4:14. But if you really want to be stunned at the size and brightness of this complex, go out at 6:10 a.m. on September 1st. Most of you can get up that day. It will be the brightest it has ever been, far brighter than Jupiter. The mission marks the start of the transition from assembling the space station to using it for continuous scientific research. Until now, assembly and maintenance activities have kept the station's crew almost fully occupied. But as completion of the International Space Station nears, time is being freed up for science experiments. The International Space Station will soon realize its potential as a world-class, low-gravity research laboratory. For the sixth year in a row, a message about the red planet is popping up in email boxes around the world. It instructs readers to go outside after dark on August 27th and behold the sky. It says Mars will look as large as the full moon. No one alive today will ever see it this way again. Well, don't believe it. Here's what will really happen if you go outside after dark on August 27th. Nothing. Mars won't be there. On that date, the red planet will be nearly 250 million kilometers away from Earth and completely absent from the evening sky. If you own a Sky Scout, you'll notice that Mars is actually below the horizon all night and won't show up for months. The Mars hoax got its start in 2003 when Earth and Mars really did have a close encounter. On August 27th of that year, Mars was only 56 million kilometers away, a 60,000-year record for Martian close approaches to Earth. Someone sent an email alerting friends to the event, and the message contained some misunderstandings and omissions, but what email doesn't? A piece of advanced technology called the forward button did the rest. Tolerant readers may say that the Mars hoax is not really a hoax because it is not an intentional trick. The composer probably believed everything he or she wrote in the message. If that's true, a better name might be the Mars misunderstanding, or maybe the confusing email about Mars you should not delete and not forward to anyone except your in-laws. A good reference is the moon illusion. Moons on the horizon look huge. Moons directly overhead look smaller. In both cases, it's the same moon, but the human mind perceives the size of the moon differently depending upon its surroundings. Likewise, your perception of Mars is affected by the planet's surroundings. Locate the planet at the end of a little dark tunnel, and it's going to look tiny, regardless of magnification. Bummer. To see Mars as big as a full moon, you will need a rocket ship, and it may take some time. Meanwhile, beware the Mars hoax. 22 earthquakes greater than 2.5 have shaken the Earth in the past 24 hours. There were 10 quakes that shook Oklahoma, and there was even one in South Carolina that measured 3.2. Tonight, X Squared Radio is live on KFNX 1100 in Phoenix. 50,000 watts of X Squared Radio bringing you the very leading edge of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. And we want you to tune in and get squared. We will be back in 40 seconds with our guest. Don't go away. X Squared Radio is about to start. And to get ready, Earth Explorers, I hope you have your seatbelts fastened. We are going to go well beyond your imagination this week. Last week's guest was Don Schmidt, co-author of Witness to Roswell. If you missed that program, don't worry. The archive is now up and running. This week, we have a researcher that has put the pieces together for ancient Egypt. Forget all those esoteric traditions and government sales pitches. You are about to see archaeology, genetics, geology, and ancient texts put together to tell the real story of who really built the greatest ancient empire on Earth. Please welcome with me Edward Malkowski. How are you, Edward?
I'm very good, thank you, and thanks for having me on.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I have to ask, how did you get interested in ancient Egypt, and what inspired you to put this amazing study together?
Well, originally it was the Bible. Long ago, when I was a teenager, I read the Bible quite a bit, and there was a very strange introduction to the story of Noah's flood in Genesis chapter 6. And it talks about giants being on the earth in those days. It also talks about the sons of God and how they took the daughters of men for wives. And it refers to these sons of God as heroes of old and men of renown. And I've always been interested in history, and I went to high school and college, and after college I became a professional. But in the mid-90s, I had my history reignited by John West and Robert Schock. They had a project over in Egypt to geologically date the Sphinx, and that caught my attention, and then I started digging and digging and digging more, and wound up writing 4 books now.
My goodness. You know, there have been literally millions of tourists and would-be archaeologists that visit Egypt every year. And they have walked the paths, and they've listened to tour guides, and they've even tried to buy ancient artifacts. And after all that, there are two camps. One says, gee, those Egyptians really built some very amazing structures. And the other camp says, I'm pretty sure the Egyptians didn't have anything to do with those amazing structures.
Right.
You know, we've been taught our whole lives that Egypt was united under, Menes during the 3rd millennium B.C., I guess, making
That's
Egypt
correct.
About, 5,000 years old. What
That's
is
correct.
Initially wrong with this understanding?
Well, the main thing is that The historians and archaeologists and Egyptologists really aren't paying attention to the records and the history of the ancient Egyptians themselves. The ancient Egyptians themselves, this is according to the papyrus of Turin, as well as the Palermo stone, that their civilization goes back to 39,000 BC. That's the first point.
That's a significant difference. Now, when were these discovered? Let's see, you're talking about the Egyptian papyrus in Thebes and the Palermo stone by what, Sir Flinders Petrie's?
Right. This is. Pardon?
When were those discovered?
Oh, these were discovered back in the early part of the 20th century, or even late 19th century. I call it dogma on how the historians that study this, they say that what happened before the first dynasty is nothing but myth, and that the ancient Egyptians are just referring to mythical times, trying to explain their existence and explain the universe. That's how they explain it away.
I wonder why they do that. I mean, what happened? Why, if this was that early, like, I don't know, mid to early 1800s, I mean, I don't even know when archaeology started being a science, but why didn't this make it into the history books as fact? Why did they just write around it?
Well, really, what happened was in the early part of the 19th century, at that time, a lot of geology and a lot of the science, as far as basing ancient history, they were kind of basing it off the Bible, where the Great Flood was the separation between prehistory and history. And along in the middle part of the 19th century, a man by the name of Charles Darwin came along, and he wrote his famous book, The Origin of Species. And that really, really plunged academia from a Bible-based study into what they call science-based study. And scientists in different disciplines hopped on board Darwin's wagon. And as time went on, more and more people began to accept that idea. And then they came up with their version of timeline for man. And, you know, as far as the actual evidence goes, what they saw is that civilization came about around 3000 BC. And that became their paradigm. And anything that would be contrary to that paradigm would either be ignored or explained away. So this fight between what they call alternative historians and historians has been going on for a very long time.
Well, that is so interesting. I see where you get the idea of dogma now. So they've just more or less created a new religion called science.
Yeah, essentially, that's correct, yeah.
How about that? Well, now there's some evidence that you have compiled from several credible sources that support the idea of a much older Giza complex. Now, it's pretty widely known that the Sphinx and the walls of its enclosure were eroded by water. But that isn't the whole story. What was discovered from the water erosion that revealed the true age of the Sphinx?
Oh, the water erosion from the Sphinx, to date the Sphinx, you have to look at the erosion. And the erosion is very, very, very important. Dr. Robert Schock went over there with John West in 91, and according to Schock, he says that the Sphinx was at the very least, built around 5000 BC. And that's a very, very conservative, and it was more likely built sometime around 10,000 BC. Now, from my point of view, what I wanted to know, Dr. Schock didn't get into any other type of erosion studies, you know, like the Mississippi or erosion studies in Australia or the Grand Canyon or even perhaps Niagara Falls. And what I wanted to do is look at how deep the erosion was in the enclosure wall. And I believe at the minimum there was 4 feet of erosion, and at the maximum there's like 6 feet of erosion. So my question was, for 6 feet of erosion, how long did that take? And I went to a number of sources, And then these are actual geologists, scientists who study erosion, to try and come up with a date and or a rate on how the limestone would erode. And what I found out is that the Sphinx is likely even much older than 10,000 BC.
Wow. Now, when you look at the limestone erosion in these other locations like the Grand Canyon and Niagara, well, those are, you know, very different topologies. One is very, very dry, and the other one's very humid and wet all the time. And when we, at least modern people, look at the Giza area, the first thing that we notice is this place is arid. There's really not much water here. So in order for the Sphinx to erode in, like, the layers or the steps that we kind of see in it, that place would have to be pretty wet. So we are talking a long time ago.
Right. Limestone, just on average, like per 1,000 years, limestone erodes anywhere from 0.87 inch up to like 4 inches. This is per 1,000 years. So, you know, if you look at per 10,000 years, we're only looking at about 8 inches up to like 40 inches. So we're looking at multiples of 10,000s of years old. And you have to have rain to do that. You can't have water erosion without rain. And that creates a great problem with the standard idea of history in Egypt's timeline, is because it hasn't rained in Egypt considerably for a very long time. Now, since about 3000 BC, the aridity of Egypt has pretty much been the same. There were more thunderstorms, or, you know, in the 3rd millennium BC as opposed to today. But nonetheless, the climate has been pretty much like it is. And when you look forward into prehistory, there is a dividing line that kind of changes the climate of our planet. And that dividing line is about 10,000 BC. There was a catastrophe at the end of the Ice Age, what scientists refer to, that changed the global climate. So we have this change from 10,000 BC to 3,000 BC. And during that time, between 10,000 BC and 3,000 BC, Egypt wasn't as arid as it is today. However, it was still arid. During that time period I'm talking about, Egypt was more like the southwest United States. They had some rainfall, and they had enough rainfall, you know, for some vegetation to grow, but it was still a semi-arid landscape. So before the Ice Age, we have to go even further back. Before 10,000 BC, you have to go way back till you find a time period when there was actually enough water to justify the erosion of the Sphinx.
Well, it seems that I've read a modern explanation or two here and there where they said, well, you know, before the Aswan Dam was built, the Nile would flood and it would come in, and the flood waters would, you know, inch up the side of the Sphinx, and that's what caused the erosion. So actually, it's really been sitting there for 3,000 years. But does that really hold water? No pun intended.
No, it doesn't hold water. And Dr. Schock addressed that question in his documentary as well as his literature. If floodwaters were responsible for the erosion in the Sphinx enclosure, the lower portions of the enclosure would be more eroded than the upper part of the Sphinx enclosure. However, you know, the actual fact is that the Sphinx enclosure is eroded more at the top and less at the bottom. So the rainwater coming down over the ground, spilling over the enclosure wall, is going to eat out the top part of the wall first, and as it finds weaknesses in the rock, it's going to drain down. So you're going to have this profile where it's tilted or slanted to the top. You're going to have more rock at the bottom and less rock at the top. And that's exactly what we see. And the way Dr. Schock put it, it's a textbook case of water rain erosion.
You know, I would have given anything to have been in that audience of hundreds of Egyptologists and archaeologists when John Anthony West, who didn't have a degree, and Dr. Schock made their presentation. I mean, it was perfect. It was backed up. It was well organized. It had plenty of evidence. How did the people in that lecture see this presentation? How did they react to it?
Well, I've seen a little video clip on it. I believe they had a little video clip in the documentary. And most of the people there were just awestruck, except for one man, Dr. Lehner, Dr. Mark Lehner. Of course, he's the voice of modern Egyptology. And he was stunned, too. And he said, okay, fine. Then where is the evidence of the culture that built the Sphinx? That's what I want to see. And, of course, there's not really an answer to that. And you know, Dr. Schock and John West don't have an answer to that because that really wasn't a part of the study. Dr. Schock is a scientist. He's a geologist. And he used his expertise to, you know, date the Sphinx by dating the geology. Mm-hmm. It caused a huge problem. There were newspaper articles coming out that, you know, kind of bad-mouthed Schock and West. It was kind of awful, actually.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's what we see happens in just about any religion, you know, when the high priests are offended by whatever evidence is put forth. It's immediately heretical, and they start building the stake at which to burn. And fortunately, we don't burn scientists anymore. We just ruin their careers. So,
yeah, that's true. That is true.
So, it's clear, then, that the builders of the Sphinx were benefactors of a much older culture, even than theirs. I mean, nobody just walks out of the shepherd's fields and hammers a Sphinx out of solid limestone.
No, I've been there. You've been there. We've seen it with our own eyes. It's more than awe-inspiring to stand there at the, I did a book signing last summer out in Denver, and my wife and I took the long way back, and we went up to South Dakota and Mount Rushmore. And one of the very, very interesting things is that when I was at Mount Rushmore, the first time I was at Mount Rushmore, I was a little boy. I was like 9 years old. There wasn't much there. There was a place where you could buy souvenirs, and there was a wooden deck, okay? That was it, and you had glasses you could see through.
Pretty smart.
But they've done quite a bit of work in the last 40 years. They have built a granite patio and a granite colonnade around that patio. So when you walk up, you're walking up these granite steps, and there's this big, long granite colonnade, and you walk through the colonnade, there's doors to the left and the right, and then you walk onto the viewing balcony, okay, that overlooks the valley, and then you have a perfect view of Mount Rushmore. Well, when I was at Mount Rushmore, I was going, my God, this is just like the Sphinx, okay? There's the Valley Temple, and it's got these granite colonnades. And you walk through the Valley Temple, you walk up the ramp, you know, like you did, you know, and then you walk onto this viewing platform, and you have this perfect view of the Sphinx. It's like, you know, this is great. It's like we did the same thing that some civilization did many tens of thousands of years ago.
I wonder if there was any planning in that.
I would have to believe it was. The Sphinx, coming out of ancient history, no one, not even the people of the Old Kingdom, you know, the first five dynasties of ancient Egypt, they really didn't have anything to say about the Sphinx. But the tradition coming forward out of that history was the Sphinx was representative of the living image. And that's all that was said about it. It was a representation of the living image. So that creates a problem. Well, what does that mean, you know?
Yeah, I mean, was there really a lion with a man's head? We'll get into that later. Now, there's some more technology that was uncovered, and this stuff is almost the stuff of just, you know, otherworldly technology. Stone vessels discovered to date back as far as 3100 BC displayed unparalleled precision.
Yes. Can you,
what made these so unique, even to this day?
Well, that's a very interesting question because it's really very, very obvious. I have a young son that's in engineering physics, and he is specializing in materials, material sciences. Mm-hmm. And that's it right there. It's material science. These stone vessels that are beautifully carved, some are granite, some are diorite. They're very hard rock, okay? The rock is so hard, like granite, for example. It's so hard that it cannot be cut with anything but a diamond. So, you know, today we don't make these stone vessels because they're just, they're useless. It costs so much money to make them that we don't do it. There's materials to work with that's a whole lot easier. You know, there's clay, there's plastic, there's glass. All of these household utensils we make with stuff that's easy to manipulate. Okay. Now this civilization was taking the hardest stuff on the planet and carving them into beautiful bowls, vases, pitchers. Okay. Now we know it's a fact that you cannot cut these with anything but diamonds. Therefore, they had to have been cut by diamonds. And they had to have been cut by tools. And because they're so symmetrical, they had to have been turned on a lathe. So, really, this is kind of fundamental stuff.
Well, yeah, fundamental for us now. But we're talking about people who, you know, pretty common belief is they didn't even have the wheel. And now we attribute, and I'd like to ask the question, was this kind of stoneware, was it common, or was it reserved for the highest, most powerful leaders, or did they have, like, basalt jar factories that made common stoneware for people out of this stuff?
Well, as far as what these stone vessels were, and, of course, this is, you have to get into a little bit of speculation, but there is one piece of fact. And I believe it was at Saqqara when Petrie was first digging at Saqqara. He was the one that uncovered a lot of these stone vessels that were so beautiful. He uncovered something like 30,000 of them.
Oh, my gosh.
Okay.
That's amazing.
So these items that were being used were, you know, if there's that number in a cache, then obviously these items were fairly common. So the civilization had attained some level of technology where they knew how to manipulate very hard rock. That's what the facts say.
Hmm. Well, before I get into the sawing of the stone, there is a tool that we can see evidence of in some of the structures, like what they call the sarcophagus and the king's chamber and some other things, and that is a tube drill. Now, a tube drill is not something that can be made easily even today. We make hole saws, but a tube drill is very difficult to make because it's hard to dissipate the heat and get the torque and everything in a very thin tube to be able to get down through the stone and bury any kind of weight. There is evidence, however, all over the place that they used tube drills.
Right.
So, you know, how was the drill turned? I mean, was it turned with an ox, or did they have a machine of some kind?
Yeah, that's one of the funny things. There was a documentary series on not terribly long ago. It's in this past year or two, called Engineering an Empire. And I believe the first episode was about ancient Egypt. And so some of the archaeologists are now starting to think a little bit about machine tools and about marks. And they had this one, there's this one rock on Giza where they took as an example, and they said that, it was a powered saw, but what they had is they had an ox on each end, okay? And then they had the saw, over the block of granite, okay, and then, you know, a man would pull the ox one way and a man the other way, and that's how they would cut the granite. But the problem with that is you have to have force coming down on the saw blade, and you have to have teeth that bite into the material to remove the granite. And, you know, again, if you've had machining in school, in high school, if you had wood shop or machine shop or any kind of vocations that you're dealing with the mechanical part of it, okay, you have to have pressure, and you have to have a lot of pressure being put on that saw to bite into the granite. And, you know, the amount of weight that would be required to put on that saw could be measured in tons.
Oh my goodness.
So it's really kind of a very, very weak explanation on how to explain away those saw marks. Again, if you go to a modern day granite shop or marble shop, and I have, the only way to make those cuts is to have powered equipment, whether it's powered by air, powered by electricity, or perhaps powered even by sound. You have to have a source of power to generate enough speed for those teeth to move and to make those marks. That's
interesting.
It's a fact.
You know, and there's evidence of very long cuts through very hard stone using these saws, but there are some things in the marks that we can tell. For one thing, there's no blade wobble. And you just can't tell me you can walk oxen back and forth and not have the blade wobble. And the other thing is the cuts, and you know, I've been a carpenter and a stonemason, the cuts are circular. They're not in a straight line like a big logger's saw. They're round. So did they have circular saws embedded with diamonds?
Yes, they did. There's a place north of Giza. It's about 5 miles north of Giza. It's right off the Alexandria Highway. Excuse me. It's a place called Abu Rawash. It's not on the tourist map, and you're not supposed to go there. It's called a forbidden site. But it's a really, really neat site because they got about a third of the pyramid built, and then they stopped. So you have this unfinished pyramid that you can go see. And because it's unfinished, it's actually open. You can actually walk down the descending chamber into the subterranean chamber and look up and see the sky. It's a really neat place. But what's very, very, very unusual about it is on the south side of it, there's a great big slab of granite that's approximately 5 feet long by 3.5 feet wide and about 18 inches thick. It's pink Aswan granite, and because of that measurements, the size, the weight is somewhere around 50 or 60 tons. And what's really unique about this piece of granite is that the top 3 inches of it is really rough rock, and behind that rough rock is really, really smooth rock. And there's an arc, there's a very long arc that separates the roughness from the top of the stone and the smoothness behind that arc. It's as smooth as a baby's bottom. You put your hand on it, I've been there, you put your hand on it, it is smooth. But what's really, really neat is if you get up close, get within a few inches of the actual surface, you can see the machine feed lines left by the saw that cut it.
Wow.
It's absolutely mind-blowing. And it's just sitting right there on the south side of the pyramid for all to see.
Well, it's probably still there because it was too heavy for tourists to pack off. But
that's right. That's right. It's too heavy for anyone to pack off. I have a buddy that was there just 2 days ago, and he emailed me, and he said, "I've been to Abu Rawash. I've seen it. I got tons of pictures. It was a riot. We got chased off by the police."
Well, cab drivers will take you anywhere for a few Egyptian pounds. But
that's correct.
Then they're not going to take any responsibility for you being there. You're going to have a friend at the hotel, probably. So these tools, they're diamond tipped. They're not made of balsa wood, obviously. Are they made of carbon? Are they made of steel, copper? You know, what are they made of? The saw blade itself.
Don't really know.
Wow,
that's a question. If you've seen, have you seen the show Life After People? Have you heard of that? Or there's a couple of them.
I haven't. I never watch TV, so
never
it's
watched TV. I love those science channels and Discovery channels. And there was a show on. Actually, it's become an episode series now called Life After People. And what scientists do is mainly geologists and meteorologists. They pretend that all the people instantaneously disappeared, and then they explain what happens to the Earth after we're gone. And this is really crazy. But 1,000 years after all the people are gone, all right? You will never know that we've been here, all right? Everything that we've built, whether it's metal, concrete, wood, everything will disintegrate by the corrosive forces of nature, okay? After 1,000 years, nothing will be here except stonework, like Mount Rushmore.
Everything else will go away.
Right, everything else. So, you know, if this big 30-foot diamond-studded saw that was made from, you know, a metal alloy of iron and steel, you know, if that saw was left out when after the catastrophe happened, you know, 10,000 years ago, it's gone now. It's completely rusted away, completely disintegrated. The diamonds are still there somewhere, but they're buried in sand. You'd have to sift through tons of sand to try and find stuff. Actually, that's a really neat point. I have to wonder what is under all that sand, because when this civilization existed, that sand wasn't there. Okay, the big sand came in after, starting around 3000 BC. Okay, because when the climate changed, it first changed to semi-arid in 10,000 BC. And then became arid in 3000 BC. So there's a process of this sand blowing in from the Sahara Desert. So, you know, if we could strip away all that sand, we'd probably have our answers.
What we need is a really, really sensitive metal detector. But I know they never let you get it in the country, but there had to be a way to do it.
Oh, yeah. It's, you know, sometimes I dream about, well, what if this was actually the United States and we could do all these kinds of tests over in Giza. I think we would find some really crazy stuff down there. But it's kind of a political thing. Egypt's, you know, primary source of income is tourism, you know, and their secondary source of income is probably Egyptology. So there's a very serious political economic game going on where, you know, they need to control everything, and that's what they do.
Well, I've thought about that from time to time, and I wondered, you know, Zawi Hawass and all these guys, you know, claiming they have a franchise on Egyptology and they won't let anybody make any of these discoveries. They're really hurting their own tourist business. Imagine how many people would book a second trip to Egypt if something even older and more amazing were found.
Right. Yeah. Oh, yeah. People would flock to it. They'd have to see it. We got to see this stuff.
Yeah.
You know. My sure.
Let's take it.
But you know, then we get back into the whole dogma thing, and it's really a lot bigger than just Egyptology. Okay. It's the entire academic system. All right.
So, yeah, that's true. That's true. People base their PhDs on this person's study, and then that person's study, and then they get their PhD, and then they publish, and so you've got this pyramid of irrefutable truth,
right,
that's built upon a fallacy. And when the real truth comes out, it's like all of those PhDs topple like a house of cards.
Right.
And that's not really true. I mean, physicists discover new things all the time. Gee, we used to believe this, and now we believe that. But for some reason, archaeologists are a much more proud race. I haven't been able to figure it out yet.
Well, now this is where you get into problems between what's real science and what's not real science.
Hmm.
Okay, physicists, okay, by definition, are absolute true scientists. They use experimentation, they use hypothesis testing, and they theorize and they experiment and they change what they know and what they understand by what they see and what happens. Okay, that's true science. Physics is true science. Chemistry is true science. And to a certain extent, biology is an absolute true science. However, when you get into the historical disciplines, when you get into some of the psychological disciplines, that's not really science. They want to call it social science, but it's not really science. They do use some scientific methods and instruments, okay, to do some of their studies, but you can't test an experiment on a culture and a civilization that doesn't exist anymore. It's just not possible to do. What it really is detective work. and not science. Sure.
Yeah, exactly. And you're looking for evidence, and then you go off your own personal experience to say, well, this is what this evidence means. This person
absolutely
was killed with a candlestick in the foyer.
Absolutely right. That's exactly what they do. It's almost the same thing as religion. Okay, it's my interpretation of the evidence. All right. Now, when you look at religion, you know, who is God? Where is God? Is Jesus God? Stuff like that. All right. We have some historical evidence of that that's based in the Bible and other non-biblical writings. Okay. The problem is the interpretation. It's the same thing with archaeology and these social sciences. Okay. We have the evidence, but how do you interpret that evidence? That's the big question.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's we'll finish off this hour talking a little bit more about Egyptian let's call it pre-Egyptian technology. And then in our second hour, we're going to try to discover who these pre-Egyptians might have been. Where did they come from? What is the evidence that they existed? Were there worldwide travelers that existed then, or did everybody just live in their own neighborhood? So here we go. This is kind of an aside, but it's so fascinating, I have to bring it up. And it is the description of the pharaoh's eyes in the statues that they left.
It's
absolutely fascinating. One would think, just by looking at these in a magazine or seeing them on History Channel or something, that you're just painted on the stone, sort of like the headlights are in a NASCAR car.
Right.
Not true. No. Tell us about the pharaoh's eyes.
Oh, it's absolutely. There was a couple of scientists, ophthalmologists, that were absolutely fascinated by these eyes of several of these statues, and they did a study on how to recreate them. All right, and what they wound up doing is taking several layers of lenses of glass lenses that they formed into eyes, and putting them together to actually make these eyes. And what's so special about the eyes is, first, they're lifelike. All right, it's very difficult to recreate the human eye in a statue to make it look like it's real. But these people, whoever carved these statues, did. And you know, the scientists that did the study were absolutely amazed that the technology required to do this, but yet, you know, they were done 5,000 years ago. And what's neat about the eyes is they actually follow you around in the room. The statue's sitting there, and if you look at the statue, it looks like it's looking at you. And if you walk several feet to the right of it, it looks like its eyes are actually following you. So whoever made these statues and made the eyes of these statues knew a lot about lens technology. That's a fact.
Well, if you've ever played with a prismatic mirror, I don't know if listeners have done that or not, but in surveying, we use what's called a laser distance meter. It shoots an interferometric laser at a mirror, bounces it back to a receiver, and it can measure the distance within an inch or so, maybe half an inch. And it's a little bit of an expensive instrument, but the key is the prismatic mirror, because it does not matter if the mirror is pointing directly at you or not. The laser goes right back to the source that it came from, sort of like the straight line of photons striking your eye from this eye in the statue. So if these lenses were put together in a very precise prismatic fashion, all the light would reflect back to you, the viewer.
That's
and
absolutely
it,
correct.
If you do it for any five people looking at it, standing side by side, they would all see the light directly in their eyes. That is a very complex and precise way to make an eye. So how did they put the lenses together?
You know, that's a really good question. I don't know how they did it. I really don't. It's another one of those things that you know, the evidence of the object is there, but the evidence of the process is not.
Hmm.
So it's you know, how Stone Age people did this is really just a poor question. because the answer is that Stone Age people could not have done it.
Well, yeah. I think it's so interesting when people call them Stone Age because they used stone, and they assume that they rubbed two sticks together to make fire, and then they just very casually stick prismatic eyes onto a statue.
Yeah.
Supposed to be in someone's tomb, okay? No one's supposed to see this. And yet there it is. Ed, we have a caller on line one. Ramon, welcome to the program.
How are you doing, gentlemen?
Hi, Ramon.
I actually missed your name when I tuned on. You guys were already talking. I think I have a good idea who
Ed Olkowski's with us tonight. We're going over his book, Before the Pharaohs.
My apologies. Well, let's start with I read somewhere that they believe that the Giza Pyramid was actually, the way it was built, that they believe it was some kind of factory would be the wrong name, but some kind of power plant.
The Giza Power Plant. Yes, Christopher Dunn's book, The Giza Power Plant. I know Chris. He's a friend of mine, and he's put together a very good theory that the Great Pyramid at Giza would take energy from the Earth, from minor earthquakes, which there's minor earthquakes almost all the time somewhere in the Earth, and the Great Pyramid would take those vibrational waves. And it would move them through a series of Helmholtz resonators in the Grand Gallery up into the King's Chamber, which is completely made of granite. And there would be a solution of hydrogen gas and microwaves coming in from the north side of the pyramid, going through the chamber and out the south side of the pyramid. It would charge and then decharge that hydrogen gas and release energy going out the south side of the pyramid. So, yes, I've heard about that theory before.
Didn't he find some kind of burn marks that kind of led him to that? And didn't he do a test where, I forgot what the test was, but he gave him more energy than it should have? I don't know if he let up.
Well, what happened there... Chris has been to Egypt, it's about 8 times in the past 20 years. And for the longest time, the Great Pyramid had not been cleaned. And this is like 10 years ago, they actually closed the Great Pyramid down and scrubbed it clean, scrubbed all the stone on the inside clean. And when Chris went back, he noticed that there were burn marks in the top of the Grand Gallery, like something had exploded. And he hypothesized that the pyramid was operational, and that a major earthquake or catastrophe happened, and an explosion occurred in the King's Chamber, and that fire shot down into the Grand Gallery, and that's what caused the burn marks.
And the other question I had, to go a little bit off topic. But I kind of feel like you're going to go in that direction. I might be jumping ahead. But I saw something on Google Earth that supposedly they had, well, the people who brought it out claiming that it's Atlantis. But if you look at Google Earth, you'll see, like, it looks like a square, huge square. If you just go into and put Google Earth Atlantis and you'll see what I'm talking about. Can we look into that? I think it came out yesterday or the day before.
Where's this square actually at? I haven't heard about this. So where's that square actually at?
Just go onto Google and type in Google Earth Atlantis, and then you'll see it. Have you seen it, Dr. Agnes?
Yeah. There's a kind of a shadow of a foundation. It looks like off to the corner of the pyramid, sort of in the sand. There's nothing there. It's all been taken apart. But you can see the square of some kind of complex.
Oh, the fourth pyramid. Okay. Is it the size of a pyramid? The square?
Yeah, size of a pyramid, right.
Oh, this is fascinating.
No, I'm talking about in the ocean.
Oh.
Oh, in the ocean. Oh, you had me there for a minute, Bone.
No, I haven't seen that, heard that.
in the ocean off of Cape Verde, a few miles.
No, you got us both on that one, Ramon. Now I gotta end the show, and I gotta go do some research because Ramon asked me a question I don't know the answer to.
That'd be a great show, though.
I thought, you know, you gentlemen were gonna talk about that. But yeah, when you get a second later, just go put in Google Earth and then put Atlantis, and you'll see it's off of Cape Verde. It gives you the nautical miles where exactly is at.
Well, I do know that there's kind of a shadow foundation off to this, and I want to say the northeast, but who knows what the direction is there. And you said that's a fascinating story. What were you going to say, Ed?
That's a fascinating story, and that would be a great another show that you could do sometime, because there's some really good stuff about Atlantis and who was it, who were they, is it in the Caribbean? That'd just be a great show.
That would be really, really amazing. I want to get back to the lenses a little bit. Ramon, did you hear the part about the statue lenses, actually the eyes being stacked precision ground lenses, and that the light refracted in such a way that it made the eyes look like they were looking at you all the time, no matter where you were standing?
Yes, I actually was gonna ask you a question, referring to the lenses, but as far as the light bulb. And somehow I feel like if they did have the light bulb, the lens wouldn't surprise me. And also it wouldn't surprise me that instead of using a blade to cut, that they would use laser.
When you talk about light bulbs, are you referring to the Dendera light bulbs?
Yes, the one with the bamboo holding something up that they have a picture of.
Oh, I thought you were talking about the ones
in
the crypt at Dendera that look like they have a serpent inside of them.
Right. No one knows if those things are really light bulbs or not. The Dendera itself and those crypts are a really fascinating story. They're built underneath a temple, the Temple of Hathor, and there's actually three of them. Two of them are close to the public. Actually, all three are technically closed to the public. But two of them you can't go in. One of them, you know, if you know someone, you can go down there and then see them. What they really are is kind of a hallway. It's not really a basement. The official story is that's where they kept their statues for their rituals. But if you've ever been down there, the murals on the walls and the hieroglyphs on the walls is very, very strange. You know, I can understand perfectly why you would want to link ancient Egypt to Atlantis, because those crypts are really magnificent. As far as the light bulbs go, they look like light bulbs. They're actually not really light bulbs. They look like Crookes tube, which is really the forerunner of the TV picture tube.
Right, right. And on the walls there are what look like a lot of batteries, and the colors are very preserved, too.
Right.
They even have, it looks like the polarity of the batteries, red and blue, and it shows stacks of them, and then it shows sort of a dotted line going from battery to battery to battery, and then them all hooked together. It's quite amazing, and I'll tell you, if you're going to go there, if you're claustrophobic, forget about it, because it's just a tiny 18-inch square hole in the ground, and you slide down on your back down a ladder in there, and then it's kind of hot and not very well lit. But you better take a wide-angle lens, because you can't get far enough away from the wall to take a picture with a camera if you don't have a wide-angle lens.
Going back to the lenses, as far as the statue lenses, what kind of material, or were you able, or was anybody able to know what kind of material this was made of?
It was kind of a glass material, quartz. Okay, you know, your quartz is kind of a clear crystal. They were made of quartz.
How could ancient, I can't wrap my head around that. How could ancient man do that? Can you do that with a ancient furnace?
Well, you can actually make lenses by hand using a rubbing compound. You just take two pieces of quartz and start rubbing them together in circular motion, and one will become naturally convex and the other concave, and you can actually hand grind lenses.
Okay. So is there evidence that this is how these statue lenses were made?
Well, there's no evidence of how they were made, really, actually, at all. The lenses are just there. The statues are there. How they were put together, don't really know. I mean, it's possible to have made them by hand. And, you know, they probably did make them hand, but they had to have tools, certain tools.
Sure.
And a certain understanding of technology and nature to be able to do that.
Right. And then the quartz is put together with a rosin, and you had to have some, you know, knowledge of how to do a rosin to get those to go together. Otherwise, they yellow, and then they don't work. They don't refract light. But if they're able to do that with lenses in a statue's face, imagine what they could do with lenses at the end of a tube. Maybe they had microscopes and telescopes. And we'll talk about that more in our next hour. Ramon, thank you so much for the call. You are always welcome to call.
Thank you, gentlemen. I'll keep listening offline.
Thank you.
All right. We'll take a short break here in about 90 seconds, and we'll let CNN do their news at the top of the hour. For our friends in the KFNX 1100 market, we'll listen to a little bit of music, and we will come back with more with Ed Makowski. His book is called Before the Pharaohs, and tell our listeners how they can get their hands on this book, Ed.
You can get your hands on this book by going to Borders or Barnes & Noble, or open up a browser and go to Amazon.com and type in Before the Pharaohs.
That's right. Or you can always go to X Squared Radio, and you can click on the link. His second book, and we're going to have him back, and we'll talk about this. It's called The Spiritual Technology of Ancient Egypt. If you could see my copy, there are post-it notes sticking out of all three sides. You'll need a good supply of post-it notes, that's for sure. All right, we will be back in about 4 minutes with more of Ed Makowski, Before the Pharaohs. Don't go away. Thank you. If you are planning next week's schedule, you should definitely include the One Spirit Weekend. They have some great special pricing for you if you click on the One Spirit Weekend banner at X Squared Radio. This could be the best weekend for your life. We're talking about October 2nd, especially if you feel like you're in life overwhelm. Check out the One Spirit Weekend down there in Sedona, Arizona. Just click on that banner at X Squared Radio. Also, October 30th through November 1st at Burlington, Wisconsin, you have a rare opportunity to hear some of the best speakers in the country. The Vortex Conference is featuring Don Schmidt, the author of Witness to Roswell, Jesse Marcel Jr., Stanton Friedman. I will be there as well. It's filling up fast, so click on the banner at X Squared Radio and get registered for the Vortex Conference in Burlington, Wisconsin. Very affordable. You may not get another chance to hear this most compelling evidence for alien visitation to Earth, among other subjects. Also, the Ark of Millions of Years is fast becoming the world's best source for 2012 events. Used by universities as a textbook series, the three-volume set is now available as a package trilogy. If you order now, you also get the first two volumes as a free audiobook downloads. So if you're not a huge reader, don't worry about it. I read them for you. The Origin and Destiny of the Earth, all the way through the 2012 end times. And a bonus, it's not all doom and gloom. Find out how to use the law of attraction to end the scarcity in your life. Order your copy today by visiting the website arkofmillionsofyears.com. That's A-R-K for Noah's Ark. This is X Squared Radio. It's a 3-hour program. If you're not getting all 3 hours, please let us know. We'll get with that affiliate and get it straightened out. Don't go anywhere. 40 seconds. We'll be back with more X Squared Radio with our guest Ed Malkowski right after this. All right, Earth Explorers, we are coming to you live from Western Idaho. Our AccuWindow forecast, rain. Welcome relief from the 180-degree temperatures we've been having lately. In our last hour, we began talking about the idea that the ancients made lenses and may have studied the stars. Well, Brophy made a stunning discovery in the desert when he stopped in an area called Napta Playa to take a rest. He found a henge, a stone henge, and in this henge was a pattern that described an alignment with the stars. But that's not all. Edward, describe for us what was accurately built into the other half of the star diagram.
Oh, this star diagram is really awesome. And Dr. Thomas Brophy, first off, he's an astrophysicist, so he really knows what he's talking about. Astrophysics is a subject that's highly complex and involves physics, involves mathematics to probably the nth degree. But this stone circle, this calendar circle, is really just part of it. And make a long story short and skip all the technical details, what he discovered in this circle, that there's two sight lines for it. And these two sight lines correspond to the movement of the constellation Orion up and down in the sky. What's interesting about this is it has to do with the precession of the equinoxes and the movement of our planet through space. There's a wobble to our planet. The axis actually changes and it moves back and forth between, I believe it's 20 degrees and 0 degrees. So the Earth wobbles. And for one complete wobble to take place is 23,000 years. So if you would be watching the night sky, and if you would be watching the constellation Orion, for example, over a long period of time, you would see Orion go up and down in the sky. Right now, and this was really neat when I was in Egypt, if you go outside, if you're in Egypt and you go outside during the night and look straight up, you can see the constellation Orion straight in the middle of the sky up overhead. But over many thousands of years, the constellation Orion will actually change its position in the sky because the Earth is changing its position. And that constellation will move down towards the horizon, and then it'll move back up. And this is all due to the 23,000-year-long wobble of the Earth. Anyway, what Dr. Brophy discovered about this calendar circle is that it aligns to the lowest position of Orion in the sky as well as the highest position of Orion in the sky. So whoever built a circle and built these lines of sight understood the precession of the equinoxes, the movement of the sky, the movement of the planet, and also the movement of the stars. So it wasn't haphazardly put together. They just didn't throw a bunch of stones together and call this, you know, a time marker. They actually understood what they were doing.
Well, that sounds really, it's going to be a great hour. And before we get started too far into it, I want to remind our listeners, especially those riding around in your cars down there in the Phoenix area, you can call in. Our toll-free number globally is 888-228-4494. And if you've got free nights and weekends on that cell phone, can get to a tower, it's 530-776-5154. That's 530-776-5154. Well, one of the amazing things that always fascinates me about observatories, and that's what I'm going to call this big calendar circle, is an observatory in the sand, I guess. When you say that it would line up with the very extremes at the equinoxes of Orion's travel in the sky, what kind of age are we talking about? I mean, what was the year when these conditions were exactly met?
I believe one was 16,000 BC, and the other one was something like 8 or 9,000 BC. It was old stuff.
That is so amazing because, well, there, like you say, this is very complicated. We're not talking about two-dimensional space here. We're talking about curved space-time over a period of 40 or 50,000 years.
Right.
That someone very accurately just plunked down in the sand. And I'm just blown away that Brophy would just happen to pull over to the side of the road and take a rest at this one place and made this discovery. Just incredible synergy. But how big was this complex? I mean, how big were the stones? Were they just laying on top of the sand? Was it carved down into a complex or something?
Well, there's actually four different parts to this to these stoneworks at Nabta Playa. The calendar circle, which we have addressed up to this point, is to the far north. And this whole complex is many hundreds of meters long. It's large. It's very large. But if you would take a bird's eye view and look at this stone complex, there's this circular hinge, this calendar circle at the very north. All right. And then a few hundred meters south, there's a number of stones, and then a few hundred more meters, there's the central point, and then below that, there's two more sets of stones. And if you look at these, you know, they really don't make any sense. It looks like they're haphazardly put together. But Dr. Brophy is an astrophysicist. He's also very interested in Egypt. And when he was looking at these, and knowing that Orion was a constellation that was revered by the Egyptians, he was looking at this And he hypothesized that perhaps this has something to do with the constellation Orion. And he started looking at it real hard. He discovered that that's exactly what the calendar circle to the north was. And then he said, well, how about these other stone markers to the south? Could they also possibly be correlated somehow with Orion? And he looked at them, he did his mathematics and his measurements, and he found out they were. Now, the strange part is the group of stones to the north are correlated with Betelgeuse system of Orion, Orion's belt, and the Beltric system. And the stones to the north were correlated with the velocity of light coming from those systems. And in the south, he did the same thing there and found out that those three sets of stones has to do with the distance to Orion's belt, the Beltric system, as well as the Betelgeuse system. So these things match up perfectly.
Mm.
But to make it even more interesting than it already is, there's a center to this complex, okay? And at the center of this complex is what's called the cow statue. It's this great big rock, like 5 feet tall by, 7 feet long. They call it the cow statue because it was carved vaguely in the shape of a cow, okay? And what the archaeologists did is they thought it was a grave marker, all right? So they dug down to bedrock. I believe it was like 10 feet down or something like that. Anyway, when they got to the bottom, they didn't find a coffin or a sarcophagus or anything. What they found was this great big round stone, and I really didn't know what it was. When Brophy looked at it, he says, this looks like a map of our galaxy, and this point over here that they, made unusual is the exact position that our solar system would be at in the galaxy.
At what time? I mean, what I'm trying to get at is this observatory was, you said, capable of mapping the speed at which the stars are moving away from and toward Earth, which is just stunning. I mean, just mind-blowing. It's a scale model of a star map.
Right.
But what was the date that it set for when it was built?
I don't. It's something 26,000 years ago. I can't remember exactly. 17,700 BC is what it was set at.
Wow.
Okay. Astonishing, I'll go ahead and quote, astonishing as it may be, this is a quote from Brophy's book, astonishing as it may be, the bedrock sculpture underneath complex structure A, which is the cow statue, the Napta Playa appears to be an accurate depiction of our Milky Way galaxy as it was oriented astronomically at a specific time. Vernal equinox, helical rising of a galactic center in 17,700 BCE.
That's a little ways back. That's like 20,000 years ago. Somebody constructed a scale model of the stars at that time. Of course, we think of it as the middle of nowhere, big desert area. But in those days, 20,000 years ago, that might have been, not all that inhospitable. They might have had regular rain and maybe fresh water, and it might have been kind of a lush area. But the fact that...
If you look at this is really 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 cool. If you look at an aerial map of Egypt and North Africa, you can actually see where the old riverbeds and creeks were. So at one time, 20,000 years ago, Northern Africa was a lush vegetative environment. It wasn't a desert.
So it wasn't that hard of a place, that harsh of a place to live with respect to weather. And usually in this, on our planet, if you don't have to employ high technology like living at the North Pole or in the middle of Death Valley. It's usually a place where you have, pretty good population, and usually you have libraries and education systems and the like. But these people didn't just wander into the area as nomads. These were astrophysicists. These were astronomers that
right.
knew the movement of the stars, and they knew that the universe was in motion. And they depicted it. How accurately were these blocks laid out? I mean, were they a few arc seconds off, or were they pretty close?
No, they were almost exact.
That's not something a Stone Age people do.
No, it's not. No, Brophy actually created a model, a statistical model. There's the old idea. And it's really a bad idea, if you ask me. If you put a monkey, a chimpanzee, in front of a typewriter, that he would eventually type out some novel or the Star Spangled Banner or something. You've heard something like that before. You know, again, it's a part of evolutionary idea. Well, Thomas Brophy made a statistical model on what are the odds of all these stones accidentally coming into alignment like he describes. And of course the answer is statistically zero. It's not possible for these stones to come into alignment by accident. It just isn't.
Now there were more things that he was able to decipher. Thank goodness he wasn't just a stone kicking tourist. Thank goodness for Brophy.
Really?
What did the observatory tell us about the masses of these stars?
Oh, the masses. I have to. It's been a long time since I.
All right, you didn't know this was going to be a test on astrophysics, so while you're researching that, I'll talk a little bit. We're not talking about cave people here. They weren't laying on their back in the sand and saying, those are the lights of ancient spirits and gods as they sit up on the blue velvet above us looking down upon us. They understood the placement of galaxies and planets and their movements and realized that they were different sizes and that they were moving toward or away from the Earth. These are things that are extremely advanced items of thought and require tremendous amounts of training and education and experience. And I'm saying that this knowledge is not innate. They either brought it with them or somebody came here and taught them, built this complex so that generation after generation people could come to this observatory out here in the desert. In those days, it might have been a lush central park in the middle of a wooden city, and learn about the stars. What a great dark sky event you could have out on this stone observatory.
Right. I have that piece of the mass for you. Okay. By applying some physics, specifically Kepler's law of planetary motion, to the megaliths in each alignment, Brophy demonstrated that the satellite megaliths might represent actual satellites of the primary stars. The physics of orbital dynamics provides that the square of the mean orbital velocity is proportional to the mass of the central star divided by the orbital distance. So, with the velocities and distances already available in the megalithic star map, Brophy was able to calculate the star's masses from the NAPTA data. He calculated that the star Betelgeuse had a value of 18 solar masses and Bellatrix 5. As the other data confirmed his beliefs, so did these. So they actually were able to calculate the mass by the positions of the megaliths they set up.
Wow. I wish they would have left some textbooks behind. That would just have been fascinating, and
I think they did. It was all in the Alexandria Library that burned.
Of course, because it's dogma of religion, we must rid this heresy.
Same thing happened to the Maya. when the conquistadors came over, they burned and melted everything they could put their hands on.
Oh, sure. Yeah, what's more valuable, a book or 4 pounds of gold? Gotcha.
Right.
So was there anything else carved into the nearby complexes? Were there other galaxies carved into it?
Actually, I believe there was a reference to Andromeda, I think.
Mm. That's a rare one for us to see here in the Northern Hemisphere. You really, it can only wintertime because then the days are short enough. And it's right after sundown. I mean, sundown happens and then it goes over the limb of the Earth. You can just barely see it.
Really. But that makes sense because Andromeda is the closest galaxy to us.
Right, right. And of course, we pass through the Sagittarius galaxy and who knows what's left of that. It had to be a school of some kind. It just had to be an amazing university of some kind. And I guess the point I'm trying to make is 20,000 years ago, 17,700 BC, this predates what modern people call Egypt. It predates Egyptians. This kind of technology, this kind of precision, we're not talking about imagination, we're not talking about religion here, we're talking about extreme space-based mathematics. And this wasn't developed overnight. This was probably old knowledge by the time it was built into this complex. So the idea that modern society has a franchise on the ruins of what was left from these ancient societies is nigh unto ludicrous. And that we, intelligent Earth explorers, should realize that there were ancient civilizations, more ancient than you'll ever find in a textbook, and they were not shepherds, they were not goat herders, they were not nomads. These were highly advanced, highly educated people. The question is, who were they and where did they come from?
Right. I think it's a notable point that when we start talking like this, people in general think that all these people had TVs, they had automobiles, and they had airplanes and jets and all the stuff we do. That's kind of the wrong way to think about it. Just because our civilization has taken a certain path to technology, to science and technology, doesn't mean that the civilization before us has taken that exact same path. Now, there's going to be some things that are going to be common, all right? Mathematics and astronomy is one of those. But they may not have had automobiles or televisions. They may have, they may not have. We just don't know. But the problem of who these people were and when did they live really isn't any evidence of that culture that we can actually dig up a piece of writing that explains we the people lived here 30,000 years ago. There's nothing that's overtly like that. However, there is a process. There is a scientific process of thought where we humans, first we philosophize about who we are and why we're here and what is nature. And we take that philosophy and we extend it into some experimentation. And this creates a science, okay? Science is the study of nature, and it's based on a philosophy. So you always have philosophy as a part of science. You can't have one without the other. And then the third part to this, from philosophy to science, the third part is technology, where technology is the application of that scientific knowledge into the real world for the good of civilization. Now, when we look at the evidence, we see that the Sphinx can be really old, older than 10,000 BC. And when we look at Nabta Playa, we see that those astronomical alignments of those stone structures go into 20,000 BC. Now, this agrees with the ancient Egyptians themselves. Their actual records say Dynasty 1 began 3,000 BC with Mens. Before them, there was rule for 10,000 years by the followers of Horus. And before them, for 20,000 years, was the rule by the gods. Now, this is where a lot of the traditional historians and Egyptologists say, well, they're saying it was a rule by the gods. And the problem is the understanding of the word God, okay? Our word God with a capital G is a very, very different meaning than the word God used by the ancient Egyptians. Where the problem came in was the translation from Egypt to Greece and then from Greek into the other languages, into our modern English. And then again, you have, you know, our modern English and our own religious tradition dictating what the meaning of the word God is. However, for ancient Egypt, that word God with a lower G really did not mean God the way we think of God. What that word actually meant was a principle of nature. In other words, science. So I could interpret that saying, you know, before the followers of Horus, there was the rule by the gods. To me, that means was before the followers of Horus, there were 20,000 years of rule by the scientists.
Uh-huh.
So that's the time zone that we're looking at. We're looking at from 10,000 BC, you know, all the way back nearly to 40,000 BC.
Interesting. Well, at least they built an observatory instead of a weapon system. Ed, we have another caller, Eli. You're on line two, and you're on X Squared Radio. Welcome to the program.
Gentlemen, good evening, and thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to comment. I've been doing a lot of reading about ancient civilizations and so forth over a number of years. And putting all the pieces of the different disciplines together like slices of a pie, you know, it seems to me that in the distant past, mankind and what we would consider civilization or just the existence of man on the earth, which is, I believe, goes back millions and millions of years, was much different than what we have an understanding of things are today. I believe that if you want to get into the Anunnaki or whatever else, Adam and Eve and so forth, that in the distant past, man's way of dealing with so-called technology was that the natural way of, I don't want to say manipulating, but using the forces of Earth, the energy of the ether and so forth, as well as consciousness power to manifest different things that we have a misunderstanding of today that we're trying to get a grasp of, such as gentlemen of yourself, to get an understanding. Although in today's man, or more recent man, we're more into the materialistic of taking natural substances and manipulating them, ore and silicon chips and so forth. I was just wanting to get your opinion about such things. Do you believe that mankind is the very essence of his being, and the way that the system was set up or his existence was way different than what it is today?
Eli, you bring up a very, very, very good point, and I agree with you 100%. Today, we have a clear separation between the material and the science and the spiritual. And this was set up back, I don't know, 400 or 500 years ago by the church and by the scientists. You don't tread on my territory, and I won't tread on your territory. That's what the church said to the scientists. The scientists said to the church. However,
the consequences are terrible if you do.
Right. The consequences are terrible because that is not a proper reflection of what reality is. We are at the same time spiritual beings as we are physical beings. And in reality, there's no separation.
Right.
So I think that Actually, I think that's those civilizations many tens of thousands of years ago were in some ways more advanced than we were, because there is evidence to suggest what you said is absolutely correct. And I think it's only now that our own civilization, if you're a fan of consciousness studies and books by physicists, you can find out that right now there is a new science kind of emerging in the 21st century that's blending the spiritual with the physical. And it's really neat stuff.
Well, have you given much thought, either one of you, that maybe this is why these evidences were left behind, so that when we found ourselves in a very materialistic, very, shall we call it, toy-oriented society, that maybe these ancient technologies would spur our memories as a being to say, wait a minute, I think we're on the wrong track here.
I think...
Well, most definitely. I've read where... it's been said in research that all the information and knowledge of our ancestors are locked away in our DNA, which then surfaces from time to time during circumstances or educational processes or so forth. And I believe that we are coming to a fork in the road, if you will, upon which way is it going to go? Is it going to be this materialistic, lawful control of mankind by the few at the top, whom I believe down through the ages, even thousands of years ago, went and sought out this information? I really don't want to say the combining of religion and science, because I believe that the ancient people saw it all as one as a whole. Like, they didn't really categorize it as such. They just knew that it was just the way it was and that they had mastery over it, because I believe, like, the further you go back thousands of years, the more closely you are to the original creation of mankind.
Well, my question is, who keeps hitting the Control-Alt-Delete button?
Yes.
You know, we should have been very advanced by now with this great observatory, 17,700 years B.C. Holy cow, we should be learning that in the sixth grade now and moving on. Why do we keep getting reset back to where we're driven to charge across the frozen tundra at each other with battle axes?
I have a theory. This is kind of how I view what you just said, and it involves the big philosophical question: why are we here? And I think the answer to why we're here, why we're these spiritual beings and living in these physical bodies, is for the sheer experience of it, okay? And there comes a point in time when our planet gets overloaded with life, with us, and I don't know if it's some cycle like Walter Crutchen suggests it is, and he may be right, or the Yuga cycles, that we get so powerful and so big and so smart and so populous that, you know, the collective consciousness, God, pushes the delete button on us. And then you start over with those same experiences all over again. Go ahead.
Well, I was just wanting to add that, for what I understand of what the ancients said and the things that I've read, is that the Earth's energy field and that the Earth itself, if you will, is as a big capacitor. Right. And that the energy that we give off, the things that we do on the earth, the things that we think, the things that we do, let's just say all the wars, the terror bombing, any negative, whatever the energy is, the earth takes it in. If it happens to be an abundance of negative energy, all right, the earth will then seek to cleanse itself and it will give it back in the form of hurricanes, earthquakes, and so forth, volcanic eruptions, the whole nine. And in that process is, I believe, one of the ways that mankind has been, you know, control-deleted back to square one, because ultimately it is our own doing, as we are mentally and consciously in and of ourselves. We're the ones doing it. And I believe that this is why we have some of the activities around the world today by the higher-ups to keep wars going, to keep people in fright and fear, and all these other negative things, because they know and they want for a upheaval so that there could be like a power grab in the midst of it on the auspices of, well, we need to do this because of this, that, and the other, blah, 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 blah. But either way, it seems to me like whatever we do on the earth, whatever we ask for, however we are, that's how the earth takes it and it tries to manifest it and do something with it, whether it's the positive or the negative. It in and of itself is rather neutral. It would rather be on a positive side, but it seems to me that's where the ultimate of what a control off the loop button is.
Well, yeah,
I agree. I just want to add, the fact that you're aware of that, and there are probably, 10 million people just like you out there that are also aware of that. We can move away from that precipice, I think. We can move the finger away from the button. I think we can make it this time.
Perhaps 2012 has something to do with that.
I think 2012 has a lot to do with it, if indeed, from what I've been reading and understanding about this twin brown dwarf Nibiru or Planet X, whatever it is to be called, if this thing does actually indeed exist and is coming back around the horn to give us a visit, because here again, even, the biblical, there's even scriptures in the Bible that says that, well, to the effect of, I can't quote it exactly off my head, but it basically boils down to the evil of mankind draws evil to it, even from the celestial bodies of the universe.
So what happens if we program the water of our planet with our own consciousness? What's more powerful, the consciousness of humankind or the Gaia technical forces of the universe floating around in the darkness of space?
Right.
Ultimately, sir, from what I understand, it is supposed to be, although it may not be that way now. Well, in some circles, if you're on the negative side, then they would say they're the ones running the show. But it still boils down to, even in that respect, that ultimately the most powerful force, as you have asked, is the human consciousness.
What do you say, Ed?
And that is the big secret of why the burnings of the various libraries of Alexandria and the ones in Africa and the Middle East, all over the world.
Because I actually agree with that.
I want us to know that.
I really, for the most part, agree with that, and would like to add to it that we have a habit, and then this is a habit that goes back to the tradition of science, 400 years, we have a habit of separating ourselves from nature. We think as human beings that we're somehow separate from everything else. But that's absolutely not true, because we are dependent upon the ecosystem of the earth. Okay, and the ecosystem of the Earth is very intricate. We have a specific orbit and a specific cycle around our sun that gives our planet this real small margin window of life in it. Okay, but that's not the end of the story. The solar system is actually dependent on the other stars around it and the rotation of the galaxy. And of course, the galaxy is dependent upon other probably unknown forces and the other galaxies around it. So it's a huge picture. And actually, this is what the ancient Egyptians were actually saying in their philosophy. I know a lot of professors and teachers like to call that the ancient Egyptians cult religion. They had a cult religion about the lion and a cult religion about this, that, and the other thing, and that they were worshiping animals. But that's not really true. The ancient Egyptians had a philosophy of life that was a totalistic philosophy of life, where you can't separate the human from nature, and that everything was interconnected. So with that said, I agree with you pretty much the whole thing.
Well, I agree with both of you, but I also believe that, you know, We have a new Library of Alexandria now. We can communicate instantly all around the planet. We can hold a talk radio program where people in Florida and Australia and Scotland and California can all listen at the same time, and we can share our ideas. And ostensibly, right now, there is no one man that can shut it off, that can burn it, so to speak.
That's right.
However, I did hear in the news, I think it was yesterday, that Obama has just passed a law giving him emergency control rights over the entire Internet for the United States.
Yeah. So he can shut it down.
That's right. That's right. That guy is doing a lot of backdoor, underhanded stuff that most people don't realize because they're too busy cheering and yelling over other issues concerning his being, if you will.
Oh, my God.
They are slowly, if you will, trying to make, what do you say, the wolf surrounding the sheep, if you will. Big time.
Right.
Well, some scary stuff going on.
So, would you also say, gentlemen, that quite possibly, I remember some years ago, I think NASA sent up a satellite that was able to, like, X-ray scan the Earth, specifically from what I read, I think it was probably like 5 or 6 years ago, that this thing had the ability to scan, like, 20 feet down through the sand, and that they were specifically scanning the desert areas of Egypt and Saudi Arabia looking for artifacts. And allegedly, there was some scientist or archaeologist, I can't remember his name or exactly when it occurred, but they did find and dig up a city that was buried underneath the sand, and allegedly, they found some interesting things.
I haven't heard that, but I would like to interject that before our civilization of the West existed, this is going to the Arab civilization between 800 A.D. and the 15th century. The Arabs were really the cornucopia of science and knowledge during that time.
Yes, they were. Yeah.
And they did have historians that wrote things down about Egypt. And there was one historian, I think his name was Mustafa, like 900 A.D. is when he lived. He commented on Giza, the Giza Plateau, and he said that when he actually went to Giza and walked, he said that the ruins, the granite rubble and structures spanned out for 2 days' walk in every direction.
I think I read that too. Yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm. So that just tells you right there that the civilization that existed is a whole lot bigger than what we see today. It's all been covered up by sand.
You know, it was interesting when we were in Egypt, we were standing at Abu Ghraib, which is on the outskirts of Cairo, and you really have to go through a grove and have a really knowledgeable cab driver, and also might help to have a bodyguard to get you out there. Well, we're out there, and it's in January. It's kind of cold relative to Egyptian weather. In fact, I think it rained a little bit that day, which is really rare. Looking off to the west, out of the desert came three large front loaders out of the middle of the desert. And we kind of said to ourselves, hello, what are you doing out there? They were digging up something really big out there in the middle of the desert.
Wow.
Well, you know, guys, I believe, from what I've read and from what I understand and through meditative prayer, I believe that there are high technological items and documents in the desert that the powers that be are out there digging up, that they're finding, that they're searching for. If you want to link it to like an Indiana Jones type of a thing, That's all right. But, you know, that's fine too. But I really think that there's stuff out there that they have found, that they have knowledge of from all the ancient texts that they're out there digging up. I also read in one book that back during World War II, that the German Nazi scientific establishment got their inspiration for the turbojet engine that they developed from an artifact that they found in India that they dug up and brought back. And it took this scientist a number of months to try to, like, figure out what this thing was. But in any event, this book, I can't remember the name of it, it was a while ago, claimed that that's how the Nazis got the inspiration to develop the jet engine that we have in wide use today, as we all know. I believe that there's stuff out there from eons back, you want to say from Anunnaki, or from back when man was really into the technology and the astrology and so forth, as well as huge cities, and I believe that we will come across that knowledge here in the next few years. There's going to be a great unveiling of a number of things that are going to come to light, but you got to know what sources to go to, because I don't believe it's going to be like in the regular news or the papers or whatever.
Well, I vote for Ed being the one out there discovering it, because if he does, he's going to write a fifth book, and we're going to read about it. That's what I want to see. You know, speaking of high technology, we were alluding to in the very beginning of this hour about the Giza power plant that was written up by Dunn. Really briefly, because we have about 9 minutes left in this hour, I don't want to make it the whole subject of the remaining hour, but it seems as though that the pyramid was not a tomb, that it was some kind of power device to gather up the vibrations of the earth and change it into another form of energy. Maybe, Ed, you could tell us really quick what the evidence for that might be and what the heck they were doing with that much electricity.
Right. Well, actually, there is some new information about the Great Pyramid, and it is going to be in my upcoming book that's going to be released in June of 2010. There's a gentleman engineer by the name of John Cadman who lives in the state of Washington, and he was a marine engineer, and he found Edward Kunkel's book, The Pharaoh's Pump, in a used bookstore, and he was fascinated by it, and he bought it, and he started reading it. Well, this goes back to the early 1960s. A man by the name of Edward Kunkel, he looked at the Great Pyramid and the cross-section of the Great Pyramid, how it was designed, and he said the Great Pyramid was a water pump. That's what he said it was. And there's good evidence to say that's correct, because around the Great Pyramid there was a retaining wall at one time that held water, and that they were moving water in from the Nile River through locks and channels. And plus there's all kinds of tunnels underneath the Giza Plateau. So he looked at the subterranean chamber and he says, this really looks familiar. And so what he hypothesized is that the underneath part of the Great Pyramid was actually a ram-style water pump that was used before the invention of electricity. And it's a really very simple process. There's a source of water that's higher than the pump, and there's a feed line or an input line going from the source of water down a tunnel into a chamber. All right, and that chamber has a waste tunnel as well as an output tunnel. And there's a valve in there, and this valve moves back and forth, creating compression in this chamber, and that's what pumps the water. So the water comes in and flows into the compression chamber, and once so much water flows in, it's compressed, and then it pushes back the valve and pushes the water out the other end. So once you get this valve going, valve moving back and forth, as long as you have a steady supply of water coming in, you have the pump moving and therefore water being pumped. So he found as many pictures as he could get of the subterranean chamber. This is absolutely fascinating stuff. He found as many pictures as he could get, and he actually built his own model of the subterranean chamber and proved without a doubt that it really was a water pump. Now, the whole pyramid was not a water pump, just the underneath part of it. So the question is, what were they doing? Because the important part of the water pump is it was creating a compression wave that was moving up through the pyramid.
Aha. Uh-huh. So the reflective surfaces that were in the ceiling of the pyramid, the idea that perhaps they were making hydrogen gas, and they were using chemicals such as various electron-rich ion solutions,
right,
to generate an electron flow, and that there was even copper wire and copper switching, and that stuff is pretty amazing. I mean, what did they find out? In 1993, they ran a small robot up one of the shafts, and I think it was a little bit like Geraldo's Valentine safe, but what actually did they find, and what was the, you know, they were expecting one thing, but people that really understand maybe what those shafts were for realized something else. What did they discover?
It was those shafts, you're talking about the Queen's Chamber shaft, right?
Right.
It was a dead end. That robot went up, and at the very end of the shaft, there was another limestone block that was there, and out of this block were two protruding copper elements that were bent down. That's all that was there.
Hmm. Well, that sounds a little bit like a limit switch of some kind. When the shaft gets full, it makes the circuit, and something happens.
That's what Dunn theorized. There was a floating item in there that was made of wood, and at one end it had like an anchor style metal device clapped to it, and once it floated up, it hit those two electrodes, and that would flip a switch to stop the input of the fluid, and as the fluid was used, it go down, it would come up, and this, you know, it'd go back and forth hitting those electrodes, making sure that the fluid was constantly going in.
Hmm. Now, does this fit into his water pump design, or is this above that level?
Well, this is actually something a little bit different. I have a little bit different theory coming out in June in my next book, and I kind of depart from that just a little bit.
Mm.
I concentrate more on the use of the compression wave coming up from the subterranean chamber, and that compression wave is moving through the Grand Gallery up into the King's Chamber, which is all made of granite. And what's doing up there, that the vibrations is actually creating a sound. And the two shafts in the King's Chamber are actually formed to create notes going into the air. So you actually have vibrations coming out of the Great Pyramid, which is in the form of sound. And what this does is it ionizes the atmosphere and creates kind of a bubble around the pyramid. And what this bubble is used for is to deflect extremely low frequencies and very low frequencies that are natural to the earth, deflect those down to the ground to spur crop growth.
Absolutely fascinating. Fascinating. So it was kind of a life force perpetuator for the entire region.
Well, let's just think about it for a minute, okay? This one group did a study a number of years ago on what it would cost to build the Great Pyramid. And this was a construction group. They specialize in consulting for big projects. And they came up with these numbers. If today we would build the Great Pyramid using the exact same materials whoever built the pyramid used, it would cost $385 billion.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. Now, if we decided to use more modern materials to accomplish the same task, building the Great Pyramid, that would cost approximately $35 billion. Whatever the case may be, it's a very large number, all right? So to think about it logically, you got to say, why would any civilization spend so many resources building a structure? Now, there's a red herring that says, well, back then they had slave labor, they had this or they had that, and they had all the manpower they wanted, and they could do anything they wanted. That's a misnomer, okay? Whether it's today or whether it's 5,000 years ago, you have to use resources to build something, okay?
Sure.
You have to have men, you have to have tools, you have to have food. All of this has to be paid for, whether it's through gold or whether it's through goods, okay? So the use of resources by any civilization is very important. It doesn't make sense that whoever built the pyramid, the people would follow a man who wanted a $35 billion headstone. Okay?
Yeah,
makes no sense whatever.
Exactly right.
However, okay, if this was a civil project, okay, for the good of all people, then they would spend that kind of money just like we do today. We build these big power plants for the good of civilization, okay? The ancient Egyptians, whoever built the pyramids, they spent so much money on the Great Pyramid because they were helping the civilization by fertilizing crop, okay? That makes sense.
That's a return on investment that helps all of society. We've got about 45 seconds left in this hour, and this is the hour when our friends in the Phoenix market, KFNX 1100, leave us to go to another program. You don't get all 3 hours of X Squared Radio. But if you want to hurry and get home, you can click on xsquaredradio.com, and you can listen to the rest of the archives. Eli, you can hang on to the break if you want. We'll be back in about 5 minutes. We're going to listen to the Portland Philharmonic Girls Choir sing about an ancient city disappearing into the ocean. We'll be back after this with more X Squared Radio.
Thank you.
Singer of the Portland Philharmonic Girls Choir is 12 years old. She also played the violin in that piece. Fascinating song about the disappearance of Atlantis into the sea. Welcome back to X Squared Radio. Are you in business? Do you want to start a business? Do you want people to know how to reach you? Then you need a business card. And there is not a better way to get a business card than Vista Prints. You get 250 cards with a choice of more than 140 background colors. The price? Free. Yeah, how does that sound? Click on the Vista Prints banner at X Squared Radio and make your mark in the world. Get a business card today. Also, the North Pole Inner Earth Expedition is focusing all of its energy on making the greatest voyage in Earth's history a reality. You can be a part of history by going to facebook.com/nipee.org. That's N-P-I-E-E, stands for North Pole Inner Earth Expedition.org. And then go to the fan shop. Simply click the share button on the widget in the fan shop and follow the instructions to get it into your profile page on Facebook. It's free, and you'll be helping the expedition achieve its funding goals. We need 200,000 profiles with the Nippy widget. It's a great plan to help this nonprofit effort to find out if the Earth is hollow or not. Also, there is some place you should visit before the end of the week. The Horizon Project is probably the most important examination of future Earth events in the world today. You should click on the Horizon Project banner at X Squared Radio, and you'll not only get $5 off the purchase, but you're going to really get to see a great History Channel, Discovery Channel quality documentary. And you definitely want the uncut version with all the bonus material. Trust me, it may be one of the most important purchases you ever make. Click on the Horizon Project banner at X Squared Radio today. We'll be back in 40 seconds with the final hour of X Squared Radio. Don't go away. Welcome back to the third and final hour, August 30th, X Squared Radio. We're coming to you live from Western Idaho. My guest, Edward Makowski, his book, Before the Pharaohs. You can pick it up everywhere. This is the hour when we tend to go a little bit past your imagination, but hang on, we'll return you safely to Earth. Okay, we're going to shift the discussion a little bit, try to figure out who the early Egyptians really were. We've already established a dateline that goes well back before, shall we call it, the religion of archaeology has told us where Egypt started and who built the pyramids and how far back things go. My question is, Ed, is there any evidence that these ancients were indigenous people, or is there support for the idea they came from somewhere else?
Well, as far as my opinion goes,
it's not possible to rule out that they were extraterrestrial. But all the evidence I've looked at, they were indigenous.
Okay, well, I mean, not indigenous to Earth, but they weren't indigenous to North Africa. I mean, you make note that there was a sort of North African Dark Age from 16,000 to 9,000 BC.
Right.
So there really wasn't any sort of technologically savvy group that possessed to a point of breakthrough that the Giza complex would require. So do you think a more advanced group came there by sea from somewhere else on the planet?
No, I think that the civilization that we're talking about really existed all across Central America, the top portions of South America, the Caribbean. This band of tropical climate existed all the way from around the world. Is where this civilization existed. They lived in the lush, you know, fertile part of our planet. And they centered, as far as the Eastern Hemisphere is concerned, they centered themselves around the Mediterranean Sea. But at that time, it was not the Mediterranean Sea as we know it. I guess the best way to describe it was like the Great Lakes of North America. So instead of one big sea, you had, you know, four or five freshwater lakes. Okay. And this is really, really good stuff. Even in the past 10 years, in Iran, there was a flood, and this flood was a really disaster flood, and it opened up a bunch of tombs that no one knew existed. And guess what they found in these tombs? They found the same type of stuff that you would find in Egypt, like the beautiful stonewares that we were talking about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
They're finding this same kind of stuff in Iran, which is several countries separated from Egypt. So and then there's Lebanon. There's a place in Lebanon, not far from Beirut, called Baalbek, where they have three of the largest stones ever made by man. One is actually still in its quarry. And this stone is so big that it weighs something like 1,200 tons. One of them was moved from the quarry into a temple area and used as a foundation stone.
Well, how far was that? How far did they move this stone? I mean, that's like a million pounds.
Yeah, it was like a mile or so. It wasn't a long distance, but it wasn't a short distance either.
Well, I don't care how many people you stack around a stone that size. There's no way humans can pick a stone up like that.
No, there isn't. Oh, there's one guy, I can't remember you said you remember his name. His name was Christian O'Brien. He wrote a book called The Shining Ones. And he did some kind of mathematical engineering study on what it would take to move one of these stones. And long story short, it's impossible because there's not strong enough rope to do it. Even if you had the number of elephants required to pull the tonnage, you still couldn't have a strong enough rope.
Very interesting. Something amazing. I don't know. That's where I get the idea that maybe not indigenous people to that area. I know one thing. When you go to Tula, for instance, you stand on one of the buildings there in Tula, you'll see that they have statues of bearded visitors and teachers. Beards were not common among the Indians, and yet here they are carved into stone in the Yucatan.
Right. That's absolutely correct.
So, I mean, the idea that the Egyptians were a seafaring people that traveled the world, I mean, is not common. We don't really believe that the Egyptians sailed the world. But somebody did.
Actually, there was a book on China. It came out relatively recently in the last couple of years. This is an actual academic historian, and he was saying that China had been sailing the world long before we ever did. Here we're talking, I believe it was like the 10th century or something like that. So this whole idea that we have the market cornered on sailing and ships, I think is wrong. There's also the fact that they found cocaine and tobacco in Egyptian mummies. And we all know that cocaine and tobacco is native only to South America. So the question how they got those goods, you know, well, they had to get it by sea trade.
Sure. And maybe it wasn't Egyptians that went there, but maybe they came here. Now, there's a pretty progressive, I'm going to call him progressive because he definitely thought outside the box. And he really, both he and his wife really did great work, in my opinion. And that's the Les Plongeons. Just after the American Civil War, they traveled to the Yucatan Peninsula to make photographs using his newly developed photographic technique. And he began, in Uxmal, and then he went to Chichen Itza. And from what I could gather, he was amazingly successful in finding and interpreting his findings,
right,
much to the chagrin of the American academic community who had their own ideas.
Right.
So how did that go? I mean, what did he uncover there?
Well, for Les Plongeons and his wife, it went badly as far as the academics go. They quickly, he was a true archaeologist. He was part of academia. And when he went down to South America, to Central America, to the Yucatan, to study, he did it the right way, okay? He lived down there, and he learned to speak the language, and he intermingled with the natives, and he learned from them, and then he did his archaeology and took his photographs. And what he came up with was that there is a story that has been handed down and has been written down, and the actual alphabet explains the story. Their alphabet actually explains the story, and it's the story of Queen Mu and the Egyptian Sphinx. And what he says from these ruins and these hieroglyphs that he deciphered was a story of this Queen Mu, as she had two brothers. One of them was to be her husband, and one of them was not. But the one that was not to be her husband was jealous, and he wanted to kill the other brother. So he did, and then Queen Mu was in fear of her life, and she planned to vacate the country, to leave. She originally had planned to go to Atlantis, but Atlantis had already been destroyed, had already sunk into the sea. So she continued on to her cousins in Egypt. And then when she got there, she had the Sphinx built in honor of her deceased loved one.
That is absolutely fascinating. Unbelievable. I mean, so Les Plongeons was familiar with masonry, like Freemasonry. What evidence did he find that linked the two civilizations through masonry?
Through masonry, he found, both of them built pyramids, okay? And a lot of people think that the biggest pyramid in the world is the Great Pyramid in Egypt. Well, that's not the case. The largest pyramid in the world, and I can't remember its name, the largest pyramid in the world is actually in the Yucatan from the Maya. And it's so large, this pyramid is so large that it's mistaken for a natural hill. All right? There's growth on it, there's trees growing on it, there's, you know, all kinds of vegetation growing on it. But once you start climbing it and start looking at it and digging around, you'll see that it's an actual pyramid and not, you know, a natural hill.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, okay, both societies were pyramid builders. Maybe the one in the Yucatan isn't a water pump, but you definitely have a similarity there that cannot be refuted. Now, the idea that Queen Mu and her entourage, or whatever support staff she left at the Yucatan with, went to Egypt, did she find a pyramid there, or did she have the Sphinx built and then have the pyramid built?
I don't believe she had the pyramid built, but she did have the Sphinx built. And there is other evidence in Egypt. I can't remember the exact spot, but there's actually a temple of the Maya in Egypt. And according to the ancient Egyptian tradition from the Wisdom Keepers, that temple of the Maya is in reference to the Mayan civilization of the Yucatan.
Very interesting. So when she arrived, now, you know, she doesn't speak the same language. She is from a different culture. Maybe some separated genetics. When she arrived, was she well received in the Egyptian area?
Well, it was according to the story of Queen Mu. They were relatives. They were like sister civilizations.
Did she have another name in Egypt, or did they call her Queen Mu?
I do believe that she's also referred to as Isis.
So Isis is one of the most important figures in all of Egypt. I mean, when you go to Abydos and you go to the other complexes, Edfu and around there, you see Isis everywhere. I mean, she's like a major, major figure.
Right.
So, you know, let's ask the same question Laplanjian asked. Is the Sphinx the totem of Prince Ko, her brother?
Well, there is a Sphinx in the Yucatan, and according to Laplanjian, that the Egyptian Sphinx was modeled after the Mayan Sphinx.
Very interesting. Very interesting. So if we go back to our first hour, when the list of ancient rulers of the land now called Egypt, we recall it got back to Mens, and then prior to that there was a list of beings that fell into myth and they were called gods. The last of them was named Horus. In your book, you record that in Mayan, the name was Hormakhu, and
right.
Horus, you know, Horus caught up with and killed Seth, his father Osiris's murderer. So
that's correct.
Tell us the amazing symbolism in Mayan society that supports this story.
Well, yeah, there's this. This is where you get into to alphabets and the way the Maya had their alphabet and the way the Egyptians had their alphabet. I'm trying to pull up some detail here. So I can talk better about it. But their alphabets are very similar in the way they're constructed. The symbol for water in Egypt is very similar to the symbol for water in Maya. The symbol for land is very similar too. And there's a number of other symbols that are nearly identical. So one would have to think that at one time these two civilizations had the same parent civilization.
Well, do you think they divided up, or do you think they had one origin or the other? Do you think, let's just call it pre-Egypt, when things were lush and green and then began to get more arid, do you think that they just vacated the premises and went to the Yucatan where it's still lush and green today, or do you think the other way around, or did they come from someplace else like Mu or Atlantis?
Well, this is I like to base my opinion here on a biblical story. It's the story of the Tower of Babel. A lot of people, it's a very familiar story. It's in a lot of children's books, religious children's books. And it says that there was a Tower of Babel, that man was going to build this tower to God, and God was upset that man was being so indignant that he struck down mankind and changed his language and scattered him throughout the earth. That's the general idea of the story. But there's some very interesting points in that story that a lot of people kind of look over. In the very first part of the story, it explains that mankind had a common language and a single mind. And whatever they put their mind to, they could accomplish. And then they built this tower trying to reach up to God. And then God was mad and they became scattered and their language changed. Now, the story of the Tower of Babel is not specific to the Hebrew people. It was a story like all those early Genesis stories. It was a story that was common history to the ancient peoples. It just so happens that Moses, you know, actually included these stories in the first part of his books. But the important part is, what is the story telling us? And I view those stories of Genesis as an actual ancient history. Okay, the people back then didn't write down this stuff because it was meaningless. That the people wrote it down because it was important, and it was important to their civilization and to the posterity of their civilization. So when you look at the Tower of Babel story pragmatically, before the catastrophe, you have a civilization of one language and a common mind who could accomplish anything. Then you have this catastrophe by God, and why I say it's like that is we always have a habit of blaming God. Whenever something bad happens, you know, for an unknown reason, we blame God. For example, a tornado hits my house tonight, you know, for no reason at all and destroys my house, you know, maybe kills my wife or something like that. There's no reason for it. So I cry out in anguish, God, why did you do this? It's that same principle. But in order to tell the story, that they have to use some symbolism to explain what's going on. So the symbolism is that this Tower of Babel is a representative of what civilization could accomplish. In other words, it was a very great civilization. And we also know specifically that they said it was a common language. Then afterwards, we have scattered people with different languages, okay? Now, understanding that this didn't happen in the wink of an eye and everything magically just happened, okay, how can we explain this story? Very simple. We have a grand unified civilization. Then we have this catastrophe that kills off most of the people, all right? What would happen, and this is consistent with the story, what would happen under that scenario is the survivors would live in scattered pockets across the globe. And as time went on, in generation after generation, the languages would slowly change according to whatever group you were in. So this explains the scattering and the different languages of the people throughout the earth. So right there it says that there was a grand unified civilization. So in my opinion, this Egypt, ancient Egypt, super ancient Egypt, prehistoric Egypt, prehistoric Maya, they were kind of all one civilization. And if you want to put a name on it, you can go ahead and call it Atlantis if you want.
Okay, so they had a common origin, and the languages get a little confused, and they get driven by some force or another. Maybe it was weather, maybe it was earth cataclysms, or maybe it was just, I can't understand a word you're saying, and so I'm going to head over here with these people who do. That's, you know, it's an interesting story. I think there is some merit to it, and certainly there is evidence that there is a commonality between the sounds and the phonetic setup of these different languages. But there is a universal language that didn't change, and that's the language of mathematics.
Right.
The Egyptians, you know, they used mathematical harmonics in their construction and in their art. And it's pretty evident that maybe the Mayans did the same thing. How did these two civilizations express their mathematics?
Well, the ancient Egyptians expressed their mathematics in their architecture. And the ancient Mayans did almost the exact same thing.
Well, when we talk about mathematics, we go back as far as possible. I mean, math is really discovered. It's not really invented because it's just kind of innate. But still, for those of you that are out there struggling with mathematics and you're taking college algebra, know this, there is crying in mathematics, so it's okay. In fact, just after you finish crying over your homework is when you get it. So I used to teach college algebra, and I had students that just would get very frustrated. And I said, that's okay. This is part of the process, all right? You're going to get it. But for some, mathematics becomes sort of inspirational. It becomes almost spiritual for them. And one such individual was named Pythagoras. When did he live, and what did he discover?
Oh, Pythagoras. Pythagoras was a Greek philosopher. He lived around 500, 400 BC. And he is well known for his geometric proof, the Pythagoras theorem. And you're quizzing me on math, which is one of my worst subjects. And his theorem states A squared plus B squared equals C squared, the sides of a triangle. That's the Pythagorean theorem. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. Well, one of the root structures in three-dimensional mathematics is the triangle. That's where trigonometry comes from, trigonometry. That's the basic block that goes from two-dimensional to three-dimensional.
That's correct.
So it's sort of the pitch to a house and the curvature of a road or the rise of staircases is all figured out using the Pythagorean theorem and variations thereof.
Right. He gets credit for the theorem, but that's a construct of Western civilization. As far as classics go, as far as our general history, the way it's taught goes, the Greeks were the beginning of Western civilization as we know it. But there's a whole other side in the story to the Greek philosophers and Pythagoras.
Aha! Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Where did he study?
He studied in ancient Egypt. We know this because there was a book written around the 2nd century AD by Iamblichus, and he was one of the last Greek philosophers. And, of course, the stories and the knowledge and understanding was handed down through the centuries from, you know, the original Plato, Socrates, Pythagoras, all the way down to Iamblichus. And he wrote the story of Pythagoras, and he was very clear that Pythagoras went to study not just around the world, but specifically in Egypt. And he studied with the Egyptian priests in the temple, and that's where he got a substantial portion of his knowledge. So, it looks like that the Egyptians are really core or center to the beginning of Western civilization.
And that's kind of what makes it cool about having internet radio. Fortunately, we didn't do this live on the radio. So, we're there. Let's see if we can get our guest back and we'll finish the question.
I am back, Brooks.
All right. Ha! Every once in a while we have technical difficulties. We've had some pretty bad weather here in Idaho. I don't know what I like worse, the 110 degrees or the rain and interruption of electrical service. But anyway, we were getting to the point where these philosophers, and I think it's kind of interesting, too, that they weren't mathematicians. We're not talking about engineers.
Right.
We're talking about thinkers, people that use their minds to think about logical relationships and how they fit together and how these irrefutable laws of logic work out in the three-dimensional world. And for lack of a better term, these philosophers, namely Pythagoras and even Socrates and others, became inspired about these irrefutable relationships between rays and angles and sides and forces, and they're actually the basis for all modern physics and forces and even astronomy. And we revealed that Pythagoras studied in Egypt, and so he was privy to, I guess, what we call the Egyptian mystery schools.
Right.
So fill us in from there.
Well, the Egyptian mystery school, the Egyptian mystery, a lot of people really have no idea what the Egyptian mystery is. You hear that word a lot, that phrase a lot, the Egyptian mystery school, the temple priests and the temple, but no one really comes out and it explains it very well. But there is a temple in Luxor. Typically it's referred to as the temple of Amun, which is just the temple of God, Amun being the omnipresent, omnipotent God. But that's kind of not the correct name for it. The true name of the temple is the temple of Imun Mut Khonso. And Amun is God, Mut is his wife, and Khonso is their king's son. And what this temple describes, okay, it describes the physical structure of man's body, all the way from his feet into his thighs and his torso up into his head and his brain. But it also explains that Khonso, being a representative of man or mankind, is a product of two divine elements, that being Amun and Mut. So what it's doing is it's stating forth the mystery. And the mystery is man's existence as we know it. All right? We don't know who we are or where we came from. We don't know what consciousness is. We just know that it is. And this is the mystery. And really, the mystery is the same today as it was 2,000 years ago or 5,000 years ago. You have the mystery of the cosmos. You have the mystery of consciousness. You have the mystery of Earth. You have cosmology and cosmology. It is the mystery. We just don't know. And they explain it by stating that man, and this is man with a capital N, mankind is actually the cosmos itself. In other words, the cosmos in its entirety has developed into man so man can perceive the cosmos. In other words, we are the cosmos perceiving itself. That was their philosophy.
Interesting. Ed, we have a caller on line two. Scott, welcome to X Squared Radio.
Thank you. I was curious if there's an approximate date on the Sphinx in terms of when it was built. The reason why I'm asking is I've often wondered if there's a correlation between the half-man, half-lion, if it might have been built during the age of Leo, which would have been in between 10,000 and 8,000 B.C.
I have heard that theory before. That was put forth by Graham Hancock and Robert Bouval back in the late 90s. It's really a very good theory. But the reality of it is we don't really know for sure. Based upon the erosion, based upon the rates of erosion for limestone, I would have to say that the Sphinx is much older than 10,000 BC. Probably we're looking at 35,000 BC or that area.
Perhaps the previous age of Leo.
That's true, yes. That could be.
If they did tend to come around.
Professor.
I went to a Lazarus workshop years ago. It was on spiritual ancestry, and Lazarus talked about Atlantis and Lemuria. And we you know, during meditations, went back and experienced lifetimes in those places. And Lazarus spoke of a tool that they perhaps used in Egypt where they could dematerialize a stone and rematerialize a stone with this tool. And that's all Lazarus said at that time about this particular device. But I was wondering if that might be something to look for, or something that could perhaps explain certain things.
When you say Lazarus, who exactly are you talking about?
Lazarus is channeled by Jack Purcell. Lazarus kind of follows along the lines of Edgar Cayce and what Edgar Cayce wrote about Atlantis and so on and so forth.
Right. I haven't heard any evidence or any device like that. As far as Edgar Cayce is concerned, he's been dead on center on a lot of things. So some of the stuff he says about Atlantis, it's Dr. Shock. Edgar Cayce prophesied long ago, back in the 30s, that they would find the Hall of Records underneath the paws of the Sphinx. Well, you know, a lot of people don't like that, but when Dr. Shock was over there in 91 doing his study of the Sphinx, he did some seismic refraction studies on the Sphinx enclosure, and he actually indeed found that there was a chamber underneath one of the paws of the Sphinx. And I do believe he even went so far to say that that chamber had things in it, and it was most likely man-made.
Mm-hmm. During Tropical Storm Faye last year, I was trying to track the storm, but I found myself looking at the bottom of the ocean, and there is stuff in the Mid-Atlantic region that does not look nature-made. There is one structure that looks like a three-leaf clover that could have been perhaps a dock for ships. That's what it kind of struck me as being. But this was scanning the bottom of the ocean with the weather tracking satellites. They have magnification that one can look at the bottom of the ocean for stuff. There was also what looks like a mountain range at a diagonal south of the Azores, which makes me begin to wonder about things.
Excuse me. This brings up in Peru, Bolivia, Lake Titicaca and Pumapunco. There's a ruins up there called Tiwanaku, which has some really magnificent stone structures and stone buildings in the same general magnificence of ancient Egypt. And this is on the Altiplano, so it's like 10,000 feet above sea level. But the lake there, Lake Titicaca, there's an area called Pumapunco. And just like you said, there were piers. Look at there were piers underneath the ocean. There's piers, these huge stone structures that look like they were piers at one time on this lake, but it's 10,000 feet above sea level, and it looks like there's been some kind of earthquake that has just turned the whole area into a jumbled mess of stone. So, you know, that kind of agrees with what you were saying.
Fascinating stuff,
guys. Thanks,
guy.
I wanted to throw those things in.
We're glad you
I'll
did.
I'll talk to you all later.
All right.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Have a good night.
You too. Thanks for calling. It's one of the things I love about web radio. The 2 hours that we're on AM, it's kind of structured. We have to be careful where we go and what we say. But on the web, we can kind of get, you know, we have callers from all over and hundreds of thousands of people listen live. And even more, millions listen to the archives when they come into work. They just plug in their headphones and listen to whatever they want. And I'll tell you, this is our fourth year, and I love having guests like you, Ed. I bought two of your books, and I'm going to buy the third one when it comes out, and we'll read it, and we'll go over these two books, too, because we just find this stuff completely fascinating, and we try to discuss it from a deeper, maybe even more scientific point of view. And
right.
Not get so much into the, you know, alien Indiana
right.
Jones part of it. But and as far as the Egyptian mystery schools, it's kind of it's a mantra out there for the more esoteric schools or
right.
metaphysical schools. But the Egyptians, or at least the civilizations that occupied the land we call Egypt today, really were the surviving center of high technology on the earth. Now, maybe Atlantis, maybe Mu had some too, but they're under the ocean. We can't access them. Egypt,
right.
for the most part, where you're talking about one of the ancient writers standing and saying that the complexes go for a two-day walk in every direction you want to
right.
go, that technology is under the ocean of sand in that area. And if we could just get a little bit of interest in digging up the truth and understanding we as a modern society, where we came from and what we knew at one time, maybe we can jumpstart or at least push through this precipice of self-destruction and survive and maybe even rejoin the community in the galaxy.
Absolutely, I agree. But it's a political thing again. It seems to be where it always ends up, and it's a system that's been built over the past couple hundred years, and it goes all the way down to the television set. You have an academic system, and you have a religious system that has these two points of view. Now, while it seems that the religious system and the academic system are at odds against each other, they're not really, okay? Both have a very materialistic view of the world. And the way I like to describe it is they have a very exoteric view of the world.
Right.
Science specializes in science, and religion specializes in belief systems, okay? Now, the truth becomes apparent when you stop looking at the world exoterically and start looking at it esoterically. And that's what I think the mystery school, really was about, was an esoteric understanding of the world. And actually, I also think that's what the Gospels of the Bible are actually about. If you read them closely, okay, what Jesus is saying in all four of those Gospels is very esoteric. It has nothing to do with the material world.
Oh, sure. It has nothing to do with the structure of church either. They
right.
are very
absolutely.
Esoteric thoughts.
And what he's saying, I guess probably one of my favorite scriptures to talk about esotericism is in the Gospel of John. I believe it's the 10th chapter. You know, Jesus always talked in parables and riddles. Now, if he knew the truth, why in the world would he make it such a mystery and such a parable to try and explain? Well, his disciples actually grew weary of him talking in parables. And in John chapter 10, they asked him, "Would you please just tell us in plain language what you mean?" So he did.
10:34, he did it.
so he did. He said, "Okay, I'll tell you. I am in my Father, you are in me, and I am in you." Great. What does that mean? Well, if you think about it, it really means we're all the same person. We're all connected. Okay? And the only way you can really truly understand that is through esotericism, knowing that the life force that makes us who we are really is all of us. That's what it's pointing to.
Well, of course. And the only way you separate yourself from him or they is by shutting off the light.
Right.
Well, you know, the Christians weren't the only ones to think in of a single or a monotheistic system. Egyptologist, who was it, Mustafa Gadala,
right,
proclaimed that the ancient Egyptians were actually monotheistic.
They
but
were.
But how did they actually perceive God?
Okay. This is really, really, really great. I absolutely love it. Okay. God is the great unknown. He's the unknowable. Okay. The Amun is unknowable. And how the philosophical system works is, you know how they have all these statues where they have an animal's head on a person's body? You know,
right.
You've got the jackal on a body, you've got the stork's head on a body, the ibis on a body, and all this. Well, many people are confused and think this is referring to some cult worship of animals. All right? It's not. It's a way of communicating, of a way of expressing science. What they're really referring to, and this gets into a lot of the work of René Schwaller de Lubitz, who was just, in my opinion, an absolute Egyptological genius from the 1930s and 40s and 50s. These statues were really expressions. Let's take the statue of the human with the jackal head, okay? That is a representation of the scientific principle of digestion, all right? They chose the jackal, the expression of digestion as a part of the human body. Why the jackal is digestion is because that the jackal, the dog, okay, has the best digestive system there is, okay? He can eat the most putrid meat there is and digest it, all right? Let's take Thoth, for example. Thoth is the human body with the ibis head. The ibis is a stork-like bird that lives in the Nile, okay? That represents wisdom as it applies to man, all right? Why the ibis? Why the Nile stork? This is a really, really neat story. The ibis is a bird that lives among and with the crocodile. And what it does, it will sit on the beak of a crocodile and wait until it opens its mouth and feed off the parasites living in the crocodile's mouth. So the ibis, having the ability to do this and the savvy to do this, makes him a very wise bird. So there's a pyramid, so to speak, of scientific principles that come from Amun, Amun being the unknowable god. So there's Amun, and then there's Osiris and Isis and Horus, and then there's the many other 200 gods that represent represent nature and how it works. So really their system is a holistic system expressing the philosophy that there is a God, although this God is unknowable, that is responsible for all of the cosmic forces and natural forces that we know. And that's expressed in their philosophy or religion.
So God isn't really a who. God is a what?
Actually, it's even better than that. God is a concept.
Ah, very good. And that means that we, individual men and women, can become like him.
Exactly.
Very good. Very good. And I could see how, if you were going to set up a governmental control system and you wanted to tie that into religion and make people fear you even when they didn't see you because they feared death and where they would end up after death, how you would want to craft a religion to make it perpetuate itself and make the congregation be docile and unwilling to resist.
Absolutely correct.
Wow. What a wonderful world. What a wonderful world, and the study and the civilizations and the legacies that they have left behind that have stimulated our minds to think in this way, to relate to each other in this way. And if only because we, the populace, the readers of Ed's book and the listeners to X Squared Radio, way out there in the masses, if only we could have the influence upon leadership, perhaps we would stop pushing the Control-Alt-Delete button and we would truly advance as a race. Ed, it has been my distinct pleasure to have you on the program. I hope you accept my invitation to come back another time and we'll talk about your next book. I find it fascinating. I've got to buy more Post-it notes. I love the spiritual technology of ancient Egypt. The tone of the books, for those of you that are considering going out and buying them, and I highly recommend this, the tone of the books it really stimulates your thought. It isn't like a novel. It's not like a whodunit. It's very well written. It stimulates your mind. It's something you can read two pages and think about for a day. That's the kind of book you need to have on your shelf, people.
Oh, thank you very much. You hit it right on the head, because that was my original intent when I was writing the books. And my next book coming out in June is sort of the grand finale of the two previous books. It really concentrates on painting a big picture, okay? And the theme of this next book coming out is all about Civilization X. The title of the book is Ancient Egypt, 39,000 BCE, The History, Technology, and Philosophy of Civilization X. And why I call it Civilization X is because we really don't know who this prehistoric civilization was. And yes, I'll definitely come back on your show. I've enjoyed very much being here.
Fascinating. Fascinating, and I'm so glad that you accept. I've had a wonderful time. This archive will be up in a few hours, and those people coming into work tomorrow will download about a terabyte of this over the next few days. So I greatly appreciate you coming on. 3 hours goes so fast on this program. It's just like we hardly get started. But it really does take 3 hours to kind of get into the meat and potatoes of someone's idea. It's not something you can do in an hour, and certainly not punctuated and broken apart with all kinds of commercials. And so that's why we do this format this way.
It's a wonderful format. I love it, and I really enjoyed it tonight.
Excellent. Ed, you have a wonderful week, and I'll get back with you, and we'll schedule a time in a couple of months. We'll do this again.
All righty. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and good night.
Good night.
All right, Earth Explorers, there you have it. It's August 30th, Western Idaho, coming to you live. Do me a favor, September 1st, get up a little early, around 6:10 a.m., get out to look to the west and watch that International Space Station come up overhead. You are going to be amazed. I'm telling you, I don't know if you know what the scale means, but this is coming over to -3.5. It will make Jupiter look like the North Star. This thing is really going to be bright. It's going to have Discovery attached to it, and it's going to be rolling over and be very, very bright. So, check it out, and we'll see you next week on X Squared Radio. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying peace, Earth Explorers.